Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. A look behind the curtain at the hidden world of monetary control. Control that determines whether economies succeed and who benefits. Ellen Brown is a lawyer, scholar, and best-selling author of Web of Debt and is president of the Public Banking Institute. Later in the program, we'll take a look at new developments in the public banking movement. But now, here's Ellen.
Thanks. Well, this has been another interesting 2 weeks in the annals of modern monetary manipulation, starting with a paper from the Bank of England in which the Bank of England finally admitted something that money reformers have been saying for decades, that banks don't do what most people think, namely just take their depositors' money and recycle it, lending it out to their borrowers, but rather that they actually create the money they lend on their books. So they said, money creation in practice differs from some popular misconceptions. Rather than banks receiving deposits when households save and then lending them out, bank lending creates deposits. So when you take out a loan, they do it by double entry bookkeeping. They write your loan up on both sides of their books as a liability and an asset to themselves. So it comes out to zero at the bottom. But the check that they're going to let you write on this deposit account that they just opened for you is the money that will go into another bank, which will become its deposit, which it can then create credit for. So that's how our money supply is created, and that's how it multiplies through the system. So that raises the question, why are we spending so much money to outsource this business when we could be doing it ourselves in-house, or governments could be doing it in-house and saving enormous amount of money on interest and fees? Which brings up a second interesting item in the news. This was a report that Les Leopold did a really nice write-up on it in the Huffington Post, that Los Angeles has paid at least $204 million in fees to Wall Street in 2013, and probably more, in addition to principal and interest. So that's not just the regular payments they're making, but the fees, which are sort of hidden. The report was called No Small Fees, LA Spends More on Wall Street Than Our Streets. The study was issued by a coalition of 15 community organizations and unions, and it showed that due to revenue losses from the Great Recession, LA all but stopped repairing sidewalks, clearing alleys, and installing speed bumps. I'm not crazy about speed bumps, but other than that, definitely things that should be done. And they said that that figure probably underestimated the true amount because it was hard to get this report. They had to dig numbers from here and there, and many things aren't reported. They said this is the first time an accounting of fees has been exposed for a specific public entity, and that's just for LA. So if they projected it over the whole system, it could be an astounding amount of money. And Les Leopold concluded, astounding indeed, my back of the envelope estimate is that it could be a total of more than $50 billion a year across the country, enough to provide free tuition at every public college and university in the country. So that's a bit shocking. And that's just the fees. Again, that's something that we could save if we had our own banks, so we were doing our own banking in-house, or our local governments were doing their own banking in-house. And then the third report that I thought was really interesting, which is what I'm going to write on next, what came from Europe, the European countries have finally agreed on a banking union. This is something they've been negotiating for a long time. The reports are all in the political dealings and how they finally came to agreement. But what they don't mention is that last summer when they were working out the proposal, they built into this deal that the banks would first have to bail in their creditors' money before they could tap up the countries of the European Union. And also the creditors that they were tapping up were not just investors, but actually their depositors. So bail-ins are now official in Europe. What seems shocking to me is that they're going to bail in the depositors' money, and whatever is left over, they're going to get out of the government. So they're going to hit up the depositors and the taxpayers. The banks win both ways. They still get to go on their merry way. Why are they not nationalizing the banks the way Sweden did very successfully and the way we used to do? it was in the FDIC rules, and we did it with Continental Illinois in 1994, then the largest bankruptcy in the country. That was the fourth largest bank in the country, and that worked out very well. But for some reason, nationalization is no longer on the table, and it's all about saving these private mega banks no matter what. And then, not quite so recently, but I wrote an article on Gail McLaughlin, who is mayor of Richmond, California, and her fight with the banks. And that's what our interview is going to be about today. Today's hot topic is a very innovative approach to fixing the problem of underwater mortgages. Those are mortgages on which the borrower owes substantially more than the home is actually worth. It's a serious problem today, with nearly 20% of U.S. mortgages underwater. That comes to about 10 million homes, and many of them are expected to go into foreclosure, which would be a serious problem for the economy. It's even worse in Richmond, California, where almost half the mortgages are underwater. I wrote an article on that recently and on Richmond's innovative solution to the problem, which is posted on my blog at ellenbrown.com. Mayor Gail McLaughlin is boldly proposing to take underwater mortgages by eminent domain and renegotiate them on behalf of homeowners. Taking properties by eminent domain is something that local governments are allowed to do if they can show a public purpose or that it's in the public interest and if they pay fair market value to the owners. Gail McLaughlin's a member of the Green Party, which takes no corporate money, so she has been able to stand up to the corporations. She first ran for mayor 10 years ago when she and other activists were bumping their heads up against Wall Street and decided to take matters in their own hands. The first big corporation she took on was Chevron, which dominates the Richmond scene, and she actually won. She won a tax settlement of $114 million. So now she's taking on Wall Street with her eminent domain plan. As soon as it got announced, though, some big banks filed a lawsuit to stop it. They claimed that it was an unconstitutional taking of property without due process and a breach of contract. But the judge dismissed the suit as premature. However, the banks made it clear that if Richmond or any other city tried it, they would be suing. So what I wrote about in my article was a way that Richmond could beat those charges. The city can offer to pay fair market value to anyone who can prove clear title to the mortgages. The catch is that the banks probably won't be able to prove clear title because virtually all of the mortgages that are being targeted are securitizations. That means the mortgage was chopped up and sold to investors as mortgage-backed securities and collateralized debt obligations. And in virtually all of these cases, there's a question whether the trust actually got the mortgages within the period required by law. The investors are represented by real estate trusts formed under New York law, and under the terms of their pooling and servicing agreement, the mortgages had to have been assigned to the trust by a certain date within a few weeks of closing. And we know from all the robo-signings that they weren't. That means the banks won't be able to prove that they own the properties. You might be wondering why the mortgages weren't assigned by the closing date. That's a very interesting question and something that I wonder too and that I plan to ask our esteemed guest today, Professor Robert Hockett, along with many other things. Bob Hockett originated the eminent domain plan for Richmond and other cities. I quoted him in my earlier article, and he responded with a nice email, and we had an email exchange, and now he has graciously agreed to be interviewed. So it's my great pleasure to introduce Professor Bob Hockett, who currently teaches law at Cornell Law School. He's a graduate of Yale Law School and Oxford University and has clerked for the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Tenth Circuit. He also does regular consulting work for the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, the International Monetary Fund, the Occupy Cooperative, and a number of federal and state legislators and local governments. Takes a particular interest in financial and monetary law and in establishing a just, prosperous, and sustainable economic order. Very impressive credentials. Welcome, Bob.
Thanks, Ellen. It's so good to be with you. What an honor.
Thanks. So, to bring our listeners up to speed, can you tell us what the eminent domain plan is and what sorts of problems it meant to address?
Sure, yeah. So the basic idea is this. There are a good many loans which, as you mentioned, are tied up in so-called private label securitization trusts. What that means is that these particular loans are held by legal entities known as trusts, and then various investors in those trusts who have supplied the money that the trust has used to acquire those mortgage loans hold bonds that those trusts issue, right? So you've got these bondholders who are the ultimate creditors in interest on the mortgage loans. That's to say, anytime a mortgage loan payment is made on one of these loans, it ultimately is plowed back over to the bondholders in the trust, right, those who've invested in the trust. But what that means in turn is that the bondholders themselves are not able to write down any of these loans, even when doing so would be good for them themselves, right? Because as you noted, a good many of these loans are underwater. It's subject to enormous default risk, right? There's a very high likelihood that the borrower on that loan is going to default. For that reason, it's typically in the interest of the creditors to write down those loans to render them more sustainable, because ultimately that improves the so-called the expected value of the loan. So it's typically in the interest of the creditor to do that, but the bondholders, when the creditors are bondholders in these securitized loans, they can't do that. They don't have the power to do that. The trust or the trustee who manages the trust would have to do that. But the problem there is that most of these securitization trusts were put together during the bubble years when people had this kind of crazy idea that housing prices can only go up. So they didn't provide for the possibility of writing down loans in adequate numbers, right? So the trustees are bound by these agreements, these so-called pooling and servicing agreements, or PSAs. They are bound not to write down loans in the numbers that are required essentially to maximize their value. So the whole idea behind the eminent domain plan is to take these particular loans out of those legal trusts so that then they can be written down in a manner that is not only good for the homeowner, that's to say, again, the borrower or the debtor, but that's also good for the ultimate creditor, for those who are owed the money on the loans, namely, in this case, the bondholders. So it is potentially a win-win sort of solution to a problem that currently doesn't have any solution and that is currently imposing a sort of lose-lose regime on the creditors and debtors out there. That's basically the idea in a nutshell. A quick point that maybe is worth making in this connection, just to kind of make a little bit more graphic the sense in which it is necessary and the sense in which it's a good idea, is this. If you look at loans that are not securitized in the way that you mentioned in your opening, if you look at loans, in other words, that are held by banks in their own portfolios, you know, so when a bank extends a loan to a particular borrower, the borrower uses the money to buy a house, and then the bank hangs on to the loan and receives regular payments on that loan from the particular house buyer or the borrower. When you're looking at a loan of that kind, typically referred to as a portfolio loan, we find that the banks that hold those loans have often written them down already voluntarily. And that's not simply because the banks are benevolent organizations or because they're altruistic. I mean, I'm sure there might well be some benevolent and altruistic bankers there, but most of the time when a bank writes down a portfolio loan in this way, it's to benefit itself because, again, it's good for the creditor in addition to being good for the debtor because, once again, when the loan is deeply underwater, it has a very high likelihood of default. So, you know, to use a stylized example, if you took out a $100 loan but there was a 60% chance of its defaulting, the expected value of that loan would only be $40, right, since there's a 60% chance of default. So if you want to raise the expected value of a loan that's deeply underwater, you have to lower the default risk, and the only way to lower the default risk is actually to write down the loan, to write down the principal on the loan. For that reason, again, these portfolio loans are often written down voluntarily by the banks that hold them, but you don't see that happening in the case of the private label securitized loans. It's not because the financial logic is any different. It's simply because of this artificial restriction under which the trustee who administers the securitized loans is operating. And that artificial restriction is what I called before the pooling and servicing agreement, or the PSA. It's basically a contract, and the contract prohibits the trustee from writing down enough of the loans to essentially maximize the value of the securitized loan portfolio. So the only way, right, to solve the problem is to bust through that particular contract, which is now serving as a kind of suicide pact between borrowers and lenders. And that's essentially what eminent domain is. It's essentially that authority pursuant to which a municipality can ignore a contract and force a sale of a loan. So essentially a municipality will buy loans from a securitization trust that the trust would ordinarily not be permitted to sell. It simply the city overrides that contract and thereby enables the trustee to sell those loans. Once the city has those loans, it can then write down the principal on the loans. That's essentially the way the plan works.
Well, but if it's good for all parties, why is it then that the banks are threatening to sue?
So here's the key point on that one. People sort of forget that banks basically play multiple roles. I usually put it, I'll often say that the banks wear multiple hats. So on the one hand, a bank can be a lender or a creditor. On the other hand, a bank might be a second lien holder. And on yet another hand, a bank might be a servicer of the loans. And the banks have different interests depending on which hat they're wearing at any given moment. So to start with the idea of a servicer, these securitized loans that you and I were talking about, the way a securitization arrangement works is not only are the loans pooled in a single trust, which is then administered by a trustee, but somebody has to go out and collect the payments from the various borrowers whose loans are in that trust. Now, that can't be the trustee, him or herself. It's typically somebody or some firm that the trustee engages to perform this task. That person or that entity that is engaged by the trustee to perform that task of collecting the payments on the loans is the person or entity known as the servicer. So the servicer goes out there and makes collections, right? Sends out letters, collection letters to the various people who owe on the loans, collects the payments, transmits them to the trustee who then passes them on along to the bondholders. Now, as it happens, the largest banking institutions in the country are also the largest servicing firms. They play that role, too. They wear that hat, too. Now, here's the key. Here's the sense in which the banks face a kind of conflict of interest as between their servicing role on the one hand and their lending role on the other. Insofar as the bank plays the role of a servicer, it derives revenue through that servicing operation that it performs. And as it happens, the servicing contracts pursuant to which this servicing of these securitized loans is done are such as to impart to the servicing organization higher fees in the event that a loan gets into trouble. So if a loan falls deeply underwater and in consequence you get multiple delayed payments, you get delinquencies, you get sort of postponements of payments. You know, sometimes the loan goes delinquent for a while, then it's brought back up to date, then it goes delinquent again, then once again it's brought current. Anytime there's any kind of change to the sort of regularity of the loan collection process, the servicer receives extra fees, you know, for his or her or its trouble, in scare quotes. And what that sort of made sense in the days of the bubble when it looked as though prices could only go up, because people figured back in those days, well, you know, delinquencies and defaults are going to be rare, right? It's going to be a rather unusual event when a particular mortgage loan goes delinquent, it goes into default. And it is kind of a pain in the neck for the poor servicer to have to deal with all of this sort of irregularity that attends a particular loan that gets into trouble and thus goes into delinquency. There's lots of, you know, extra letters that have to be sent out, phone calls that have to be made. You have to start harassing the borrower. All that kind of stuff is thought to be, you know, kind of a pain for the servicer. So it kind of looked like it might make sense to go ahead and say, okay, well, so we're going to give some extra compensation to the servicers insofar as they run into this kind of difficulty in these rare cases where loans go into delinquency and maybe even ultimately default. But what nobody seems to have anticipated is that, well, what if lots and lots and lots of loans go underwater? What if half of the mortgage loans in the country, or one-third or one-fourth, as it happens, it was somewhere between a quarter and a third of loans that went underwater after the crash. What if that many loans go underwater and begin to go delinquent and default? Well, now what had been viewed or sort of conceived initially as a kind of compensatory fee that goes to the servicer turns into a major revenue line for the servicer, right? So the servicer gets lots of money from loans that are getting into trouble, right, from delinquent loans, from loans where the payments are getting late and the like. And what that means is that the servicers have a significant interest in a continuation of the delinquency and foreclosure problem, right? They have a considerable interest, a financial interest in the troubled loan problem. And banks, insofar as they are servicing organizations, accordingly want to see continuing trouble of this sort. Another thing to remember here is that banks, in their lending roles, are not securitized lenders. The banks in their lending roles are primarily portfolio lenders. What that means in turn is that any loan that it benefits a bank to write down, the bank has already written down. So if we're now talking about writing down additional loans, namely the private label securitized loans, that doesn't actually do the banks any good because the banks are not the lenders, right? The lenders are the bondholders in those securitization trusts. And sure, banks hold some of those bonds as well, but that's not their primary form of lending. And they are not, of course, the primary holders of mortgage-backed securities. It's other kinds of financial institutions that hold those. And so what that means is that insofar as the banks have something to say about the eminent domain plan, they're speaking more from the point of view of their role as servicer than from the point of view of their role as creditor or lender. A similar story, I think, is obtained in the case of the bank's other role that I mentioned, and that is their role as second lien holder. So a lot of people know that lots of homes have not only first mortgages on them, but second mortgages as well, or second liens. The way a second lien works is, you know, you borrow from somebody to buy a home, and then now you've got that home. But the home is going up in value, of course, during the bubble years. And so there's additional equity, of course, that you are gradually coming to hold in the house because it goes up in value. And all of that extra value that it acquires, at least temporarily during the bubble that everybody thought was going to be permanent, insofar as that equity rises, but you still owe the same debt on your first lien mortgage, thought is, well, maybe there's a way to kind of make that extra equity usable now. Essentially to borrow against that rising equity in their homes. And they would often take out those loans from banks. The banks would open up for them what was called, what came to be known as a home equity line of credit. So a bank then, as a second lien holder, basically has second dibs on the value of the home after the first lien holder, the first lender, has been paid off. But the problem here is that insofar as some homeowners owe both on first lien secured loans and second lien secured loans to different parties, a particular borrower only benefits by a write-down on the first lien loan if the second lien loan is written down as well. Because basically once the homeowner is deeply underwater, he or she is strapped, right? And you're basically strapped with two loans rather than one, and you're not really going to benefit sufficiently, if only one of those loans is written down, you pretty much need both of those loans to be written down. That means, in turn, insofar as the borrower only benefits if both loans are written down, then so does the first lien holder only benefit by a write-down if the second lien loan is also written down. But here's where the rub comes in. The second lien loan holders, the bank, haven't had to do write-downs. They haven't faced the same urgency about doing write-downs as the first lien holders have faced because typically a troubled borrower, a homeowner who's in trouble on his loans, well, typically what you're going to do as a homeowner is you're going to pay the second lien monthly installment first and let the first lien holder be the one who has to wait and has to get the payment late. You're going to go delinquent on that loan, in other words, before you're going to go delinquent on the other. The reason for that is because the entity, the creditor that holds your first mortgage lien isn't going to start foreclosing right away, right? You're not going to be kicked out of your house if you're late with one monthly payment on your home loan. But you could indeed lose your equity, your home equity line of credit. You could lose your liquidity if you fall late on that payment. So ironically, what you see is you see strapped homeowners paying their second lien holders off before they pay their first lien holders. That means that the second lien holders don't have any incentive to go ahead and do a write-down. That means, in turn, that the first lien holder doesn't have much incentive to do a write-down either because, again, the first lien holder only benefits from a write-down if the second lien holder writes down as well. That means, in turn, that the second lien holders have come to be viewed as holdouts by all policymakers, all the people who have been formulating opinions about what's going wrong with the mortgage crisis. People tend to look at the second lien holders as the bad guys. Those are the banks. Now, what that means in turn, finally, and this gets now we're finally directly back to your question, is insofar as banks are second lien holders, and they are the principal second lien holders, they are terrified that the eminent domain plan will come to be used against their second lien loans just as surely as we are now contemplating using the eminent domain plan against the first lien loans. And they're terrified of losing that because they know, they realize, first of all, that they are viewed as the bad guy by everybody. Furthermore, they know that the fair value that would have to be paid in eminent domain to take a second lien would be very, very low, right? It would be much lower than what the fair value on a first lien loan would be. So what they're afraid of is that these second liens are going to be taken in eminent domain, and they're not going to get much compensation for them at all. And that means suddenly they're going to have to declare great big losses on their books that they don't currently have to declare, because they can claim that these second lien loans are valuable assets, since, after all, most borrowers are remaining current on their payments. So that's a very complex part of the story, but what it comes back to is, insofar as banks occupy this role too, and by the way, the principal second lien holding institutions are the banks, here too, they have a reason to oppose. So basically, to sum up, they wear three hats, the primary creditor hat, the second lien holder hat, and the servicer hat. Insofar as they are primary creditors, they shouldn't object to the eminent domain plan at all, because after all, they have implicitly agreed that it's a good idea insofar as they themselves have voluntarily written down the loans in their own portfolios, the first lien loans. On the other hand, insofar as the banks are wearing either of the other two hats, the servicer hat or the second lien holding hat, then they oppose it. And so they're sort of at cross purposes with themselves. The crowning irony here, by the way, is Wells Fargo, which was one of the first banks to file suit against the city of Richmond back last August, on the one hand filed suit against Richmond for contemplating the eminent domain plan, but out of the other side of its mouth was routinely boasting to everybody about how many loans that it has written down, right? How many of loans that it holds in its own portfolio that it's writing down. But the funny thing is, if you boast that you've written down loans in your own portfolio, you're basically agreeing that it's a good idea to do write-downs, and hence you're basically agreeing that the eminent domain plan is a good idea, right, for first lien loans. On the other hand, when they objected to the plan, they were not objecting in their capacity as primary creditors. They were objecting in their role either as servicer or as second lien holder or both.
Well, that's interesting, but how do you make your case to them so that it looks good to them, or don't you need to?
Well, ultimately, you don't have to, right, in one sense, right? Legally speaking, you don't have to make the case to the banks because they don't have a legal case. And indeed, we've kind of gotten a preview of that fact in the results of the two suits that have been filed already. So there was one suit filed very early August. A second suit that was almost identical was filed in either late August or early September. I can't remember the precise date. But the first suit was filed by Wells Fargo and a coalition of other financial institutions and financial interests. The second was then later filed by Deutsche Bank and another coalition of financial institutions. And in both cases, they lost. And indeed, they didn't lose exactly on the merits. They lost, in a sense, on a procedural matter. And I actually predicted this within literally like 6 minutes or so of getting the filings on the first suit. I looked at it and I thought, oh, this is not ripe, and so this is going to be dismissed for lack of ripeness. And the court, that is to say the Federal Court for the Northern District of California, did indeed dismiss first the first suit and then the second suit on grounds of lack of ripeness. Nevertheless, one ground on which you determine that a suit is not ripe is by reference to the likely success or failure on the merit. In other words, one of the things that somebody who brings suit has to show if they want to avoid a dismissal on the merits is a likelihood of prevailing on the merits once the suit becomes ripe. And obviously, neither of the plaintiff groups in these two lawsuits that were filed in late last summer, early last autumn, was able to show sufficient likelihood of prevailing on the merits as to overcome the finding of non-ripeness. So from a strictly legal point of view, we can tell already from what the court has decided that there's not a profound likelihood of prevailing on the merits, that you don't really have to satisfy the banks from, at least as far as the law is concerned. We can win in the courts if they try to sue again, irrespective of whether they agree or don't. That being said, I do think it's worth noting that nobody yet has proposed actually taking second liens in eminent domain. The city of Richmond, the first group of loans that it is targeting, the first 624 it's looking at, are loans that are not encumbered by second liens. They're just first lien loans. And it would be easy enough to arrive at some kind of a national agreement, you might say, some kind of a national settlement pursuant to which we say, okay, look, we'll leave the second lien loans intact. Or if we didn't want to do that, we might say, okay, look, even though second liens would be virtually without value and hence be virtually unnecessary to compensate or pay anything in the way of compensation to second lien holders in the event that the eminent domain plan were used, even though that's the case, if you will play ball and stop, you know, raising a ruckus and stop using all this, spending all this money, all of your depositors' money on frivolous litigation, we will agree that any second lien that is taken in eminent domain will result in the payments to you of some amount, right, some kind of reasonable amount, even though you're not entitled to any much of any compensation, given that second liens are virtually worthless if first lien loans have been taken already in eminent domain. You know, that could be done, right? That, some kind of a settlement of that sort could be arranged and agreed to, and I wish that, you know, the banks might actually come to the table to talk about that, and I think ultimately they might well do that. But if they don't, again, I'll just remind you that if somebody did, the banks would be a lot worse off because then they would get nothing. Whereas if they actually come to the table and we can get some kind of a national summit and then an agreement on, you know, basic principles pursuant to which this plan would be pursued by various cities and various parts of the country, that settlement could include provision for some methodology for determining how much compensation to pay second lien holders to, you know, once the eminent domain plan is put into effect.
Another problem is that the bond rating of the city has gotten worse, right? How do we figure that?
Yeah, City of Richmond. The thing about this is one way of looking at the bond rating problem or the difficulty that Richmond has had selling some of its municipal bonds since agreeing to pursue this particular plan, one way of looking at it is as one example of a broader phenomenon that I've been trying to kind of draw attention to for a long time, and I've been drawing attention to it partly with a view to explaining why it is I think that some kind of a national summit type arrangement would be a good thing to do, a summit of the sort that I referenced a moment ago. As you know, and as indeed you indicated, as you've actually quite, you know, really articulately and effectively sort of announced to the world or sort of tried to make the world mindful of for a good long time now, including in your lead-in to this particular conversation that we're having now, the financial quote-unquote services industry is huge, right? It's one of the very largest now industries in the country. Indeed, it accounts for a greater portion of GNP, I think, than any other industry at this point. I think it exceeds manufacturing by a hefty margin now. That means they've got, you know, enormous resources that they can bring to bear in trying to, you know, to harass or make life difficult for any one city that tries to act as a kind of first mover in moving forward on a plan of this sort. I sort of analogize it sometimes to, you know, say, trench warfare of the sort that you associate with, say, the First World War or the Civil War. You know, if one soldier, you know, pokes his head up above the trench before everybody else, then all of the rifles over on the other side are all aimed at that one helmet, right? All the guns are sort of brought to bear on this one target. And it's a virtual certainty, right, or at least there's a very high likelihood that this one soldier who's trying to be first is going to get shot down. And, you know, the only way that means to sort of avoid that kind of a problem where, you know, basically the whole movement is stifled because, you know, cities only move one at a time and each one gets picked off by the entire industry that, you know, aims all of its guns at that one city one at a time, is for cities to act in concert, to act together, so that, you know, you don't have all of the guns fixed on one target. Basically, to kind of level the playing field a bit, to kind of equalize things a bit by saying, okay, yeah, there are lots of financial institutions out there that constitute this enormous financial services industry, but so are there lots of cities out there that have reason to pursue a plan like this, and if we can just get them to kind of work together, we can maybe overwhelm the opposition or at least make it more difficult for the opposition to kind of shoot down the cities one at a time. The matter of the bond issue is case in point of this. So if you've got one city that finances its operations partly through the issuance of municipal bonds and all the, you know, the entire financial services industry is trying to, you know, come down on this one city and pouncing on it and using all manner of resource to try to stop it in its tracks, it has a couple of effects that relate to the likelihood of the bond issuance being successful. One is that, well, the city's prospects themselves might look kind of bad, because after all, it's one little David city, you know, Gail McLaughlin sort of conducting a lonely fight like David against the Goliath of the industry. So it kind of might look to some, you know, betting people out there that, well, the city's maybe not going to do so well, so maybe we shouldn't buy these bonds. They're probably not a good bet. Some people probably think, at least the really ultra risk averse people. Relatedly, some people might see the fact that Richmond is having to resort to the plan as an indicator of the fact that the city has a significant underwater loan problem, and indeed it is significant. As you said, about half of the loans are underwater. When people see that, they know that the city's revenue base is in trouble, right? Because where do most cities get most of their funding? They get it through property taxation. And what does the foreclosure crisis do to property prices? It drives them down. And when property prices are driven down by a foreclosure crisis, so then our city revenues dried up. Ironically, that happens at the same time that the abatement costs that the cities have to pay in order to sort of board up, you know, the abandoned homes or the foreclosed homes, in order to keep the grass cut so that the rats don't infest the grass around the lawns around these abandoned homes and so forth. All those costs go up as well. So city finances take a huge hit when there's a serious underwater loan problem. And the fact that Richmond is the first city in the country to move forward with the eminent domain plan sort of conveys to the world out there that this city has a major foreclosure problem, and that means its prospects look, at least for the time being, less good than they otherwise would be. And hence, of course, it's going to be harder for the city to, you know, get people to buy those bonds. And then finally, thirdly and relatedly, if the financial services industry, which is itself responsible for rating the bonds, right, for assigning scores to the bonds, saying which ones are investment grade and which ones are not, which ones are good bets and which ones are not, if the same industry that's fighting the city is also the industry that determines the scores or the ratings that the city's bonds receive, it's not any wonder, is it, that they get poor ratings, right, and thus they end up being not very attractive investment prospects because they've got these bad ratings. So, you know, in a way, the trouble that Richmond has had with its latest bond issuance is just a kind of, I think, again, a sort of case in point, you know, one illustration of a much broader phenomenon.
What I would suggest would be for them to form a city-owned bank or county-owned bank, or that I guess there's been talk of several of those cities banding together to form a bank, and then they could be their own creditors and they wouldn't need to be dependent on selling bonds. What do you think?
Well, I think, you know, so you're, of course, particularly well-known as probably the nation's premier advocate of public banks, public banking on the sort of Bank of North Dakota model. And as you know, I am also an advocate of that method, right, of that idea. And I'm a great proponent of and a great fan of public banking and a great fan of yours, among other reasons, because you're such an effective and impassioned and longstanding advocate of public banks. And I do think that a public bank in California constructed along the same lines as or along similar lines to that of the Bank of North Dakota would at least partly obviate the problem, right? You wouldn't have to sort of tap the broader financial markets, which, as you know, are sort of subject to lots of whim-determined behavior on the part of its participants, and furthermore are in large part, you know, sort of controlled by or determined by a relatively small number of industry groups. It would be a way of getting around that or not having to sort of tap those particular markets. So I do think that would be, you know, quite helpful, right? I think I certainly would agree that should be done. At the same time, though, I mean, whether that is done or is not done, it's still, I think, a good idea for cities to group together and work in concert in pursuit of a plan like this. In effect, for reasons that are kind of readily gleaned from what I just said about the kind of David versus Goliath problem, like if multiple cities are doing this at once, first of all, it's hard for, you know, industry groups to kind of train all the guns on one city at a time. But if multiple cities are doing this at once, it's a lot harder for people who want to buy municipal bonds to say, well, I'm just going to avoid the Richmond bonds because they're pursuing this particular plan. Because if it turns out that other cities that are also issuing bonds are also pursuing a plan like this, you know, Richmond is no longer unique, and so its bonds are no longer uniquely stigmatized, right, by this particular opprobrium that the industry is attaching to them, you know, by dint of Richmond's pursuing the eminent domain plan.
Well, why do you think that the mortgages weren't assigned to the trust within the closing period? I mean, it seems to have happened to virtually all of them. So what were they up to? Why are they waiting until foreclosure before they assign them?
I don't know if there's a single uniform answer to that. I think maybe the best simple or straightforward sort of single answer that I could provide is that, as you know, during the bubble years, the mortgage-backed securities that were issued by the securitization trusts became the object of fad investments, right, or fad investment strategies. It seems like we kind of go, our financial economy sort of goes through this kind of euphoria, this kind of, you know, this kind of bacchanal followed by, you know, disgust. You know, every decade or so, there's always some object of fad speculative investments that everybody goes crazy about, and hence everybody wants, they're sort of all the rage, and when that happens, then the processes pursuant to which those securities are constructed or generated and then issued start getting kind of hurried, and people start cutting corners and start, you know.
I know that's the theory, I mean the prevailing theory, but here's what I suspect. They were actually using those mortgage-backed securities as collateral in the repo market. And in the repo market, you can't have it is a purchase and sale, and you can't actually sell a thing that's owned by a trust. So they were signed in blank, so they were negotiable instruments. They could be traded without, they were non-recourse, et cetera. So they worked in the repo market. And so they were double dealing with these mortgage-backed securities. And if that's true, then it seems to me that it's inherent fraud and that that would be a pretty good argument for, you know, renegotiating the whole thing at best or maybe just redoing the whole system.
Yeah, so I think, I mean, so first of all, you're absolutely right, right? I mean, one of the primary drivers of the fad for the creation of and the issuance of mortgage-backed securities was the fact that the repo markets had grown so rapidly that they had come to run out of sufficient quantities of financial instruments to serve as repo collateral. So it might be helpful for your listeners for us to say a little bit about how a repo transaction works and sort of what prompts it, what motivates it, how it works, why it's important, why it's dangerous. Repo, of course, is short for a sale and repurchase agreement. So in a repo transaction, of course, one party owns a particular financial instrument. It then sells it to another party with an agreement to buy it back, say, within 24 hours, maybe 48 hours at the outer bounds, for a slightly higher price, right? That slightly higher price, then, the margin between the higher price and the lower price is effectively the interest rate. It's what it costs you to borrow. So what you're effectively doing is borrowing money from somebody else by selling them something that you agree to buy back for them for a slightly higher price later. So the money that they give you then when you, in return for the thing that you're selling to them, is the money that you're borrowing, and you use that money to invest in other things. And then, of course, when you buy the thing back, you're giving the money back, but if you're buying it back at a slightly higher price, of course, you're paying back a little more than you were paid, and the difference, of course, is the interest rate. Now, this form of financing grew to becoming, you know, very popular starting in the later 1990s and kind of exploded in a really big way in the early 21st century, essentially because it's a form of very short-term borrowing. And when an institution borrows really, really short-term, it can pay a very, very low interest rate. And it was using these borrowings, in turn, to invest in longer-term financial instruments, which yield a higher rate of return. So effectively, it was a way of borrowing cheaply in order to invest expensively, so to speak, and earn, right, a hefty return on the difference between the high interest rates that you would get back from the longer-term investments you were making, the difference between those higher interest rates and those effectively low interest rates that you were paying to those from whom you were borrowing through the repo transaction. So that's the basic mechanic here. Now, the collateral that was most popular for ages in the repo markets were treasury bills, right, treasury securities, because those are very, very safe, right? Everybody regards treasury bills as sort of the gold standard these days, right? That's the safest thing to use. But the thing is that the repo markets grew by such leaps and bounds in the early 20th century that we actually ran out of treasuries. We didn't have enough treasuries to serve as repo collateral, which is, when you think about it, an astonishing fact, because the treasury market is by far the largest financial market in the world. There's no financial instrument that trades as heavily that there are as many of as U.S. treasuries. They really are a kind of a backbone of the global financial economy. God knows where we would be without them, right? And actually, as far back as Alexander Hamilton, right, we had people prognosticating that one day U.S. treasuries would end up being a really important form of money, basically, to make finance work. And that was true, but it turned out we ran out even of those. We didn't even have enough of that anymore for these repo markets. That meant that people were looking for something that might be similarly safe or might be arguably safe like treasuries that could be used as repo collateral in these transactions. And, of course, that's what the mortgage-backed securities came to be. And so the repo markets grew increasingly dependent on MBS and mortgage-backed securities. And people's need for MBS to serve as repo collateral was one of the drivers of the sort of rapid rate at which then loans were extended, including subprime loans, basically in order just to get more loans to securitize and against which to issue MBS, which could then serve as repo collateral. Given all of that, your suggestion is an entirely plausible one, right? Because it could very well be that the repo transaction wouldn't have worked. At least for some parties, it might have been difficult to sort of rely or to get them to be willing to rely on some of the MBS as collateral if there was any doubt as to who the owner of the MBS, who the ultimate owner was. So maybe that did play some role in prompting some institutions to delay, right, dotting all of the I's and crossing all of the T's that really ultimately have to be dotted and crossed in order for the MBS to be sort of fully formed. If that's the case, then, you know, you're of course quite right that it might turn out that, you know, when some of these loans are taken in eminent domain, some of the PLS loans are taken in eminent domain, it might turn out that the current holder, that the trust that holds the loans, doesn't actually own some of them, in which case nothing would actually have to be paid for them. And you can imagine if some institutions are, you know, hold lots of loans in that form, if some institutions hold lots of securitized loans that they know that they don't ultimately really have title to, what they might be doing is desperately trying to fight off the eminent domain plan because they realize that once a city uses it and then an inquiry is launched into what the fair value of the loan is and whether in fact the trust owns the loan and hence has to be paid, it'll turn out that the answer is a big fat no, right? And so that nothing has to be paid. So in other words, it might be that we've got sort of a house of cards out there and that use of the eminent domain plan will sort of expose the fact that we've got a house of cards out there. And those who are sort of living in that house are desperately trying to prevent that form of that exposure from happening. But it's an entirely plausible speculation.
That's very interesting. Thanks. All right about that. It seems to me that ultimately, you know that they're not going to allow the entire banking system to collapse, even though this is fraudulent. I mean, it's what we would call fraud. It's double dealing or playing, using it for two things, which is what bankers have always done, which is to lend out the same gold 10 times over, but they could get away with it when in real estate, we're talking about something different. Real estate, you have laws where you're supposed to record and you have to have the wet signatures from hand to hand to hand. But it seems to me that how they could work this out is say, all right, we're not going to bring down the whole banking system, but we are going to turn it over to some sort of public entity. It wouldn't have to be one city. It could be a federal entity that would say, all right, we're taking all these properties by eminent domain and we're going to, you know, sort it out and do the fair thing for all the parties.
Sure. Well, a couple quick things to say maybe in response to that. That was a very rich observation. The first version of this plan that I ever pushed out there was, you know, 5-6 years ago when it was beginning to become apparent that there was going to be a broader financial crisis that would follow on a mortgage crisis, actually was a plan pursuant to which a federal instrumentality would do the taking, right? Would do the compulsory purchasing. And indeed, that entity at the time that I was proposing was the Federal Housing Administration, or FHA. The reason being that we actually have a precedent for the eminent domain plan or for the idea of buying up troubled mortgage loans in order to keep people in their homes and write them down in a manner that renders them sustainable. And that was the old Homeowners Loan Corporation, or HOLC, that was established as one of the first moves that was made by the new Roosevelt administration in early 1933. And HOLC operated, it just worked like a charm, essentially by buying up troubled mortgage loans and then writing them down to render them sustainable. HOLC actually turned a profit. It actually recouped what would otherwise have been lost value because, again, deeply underwater loans default, and that's bad for creditors as well as for debtors. So HOLC actually turned a profit, actually proved immensely successful. But what HOLC did is it had a kind of a sunset clause. It went out of existence automatically within about a year of coming into existence. And the reason for that was because it was understood that a more permanent version of it was to be created and then to operate as its successor. And that successor institution was the Federal Housing Administration, or FHA, which was established in 1934. And FHA's mission was essentially to carry on in a permanent way with the HOLC mission, and we still have FHA to this day. And indeed, until quite recently, FHA was one of the only federal institutions or federal agencies always to have operated in the black. It has always represented a net gain to the public fisc because essentially it has always saved money that would otherwise be lost by refinancing troubled loans and by, of course, insuring mortgages as long as they conform to certain criteria. These are the so-called conforming loans. So the original version of the plan that I put forward was for FHA to be the entity that would buy these loans and would use eminent domain if necessary. It would also buy up mortgage-backed securities in some cases to put a bottom under them when they were being undervalued by the market. Ultimately, what we did is, you know, the New York Fed did buy MBS pursuant to the Maiden Lane Fund programs. Those programs actually did turn a profit, just as FHA has done historically and just as FHA would have done under the plan that I was proposing. But they didn't end up using FHA or any other federal instrumentality to buy the loans themselves. So I think your idea of going federal is a good one. For a while, I actually had real hope that what was to become the Obama administration might adopt a plan like this, but ultimately they just dropped it. They decided to put all their chips on cram down by trying to get the bankruptcy code amended, and of course that ended up going nowhere, even though they tried twice, I think in 2009 and 2010, if I'm remembering correctly now. That means we're stuck with the states or the municipalities. In one way, that's a blessing because, as you've noted before as well, the crisis is very locally concentrated, with some cities being hit really hard and other cities being barely touched. It's sometimes easier to kind of galvanize attention in a city, a hard-hit city, than it is at the federal level where, you know, the federal government represents not only troubled cities but also cities that haven't been hit so hard. In that sense, it could be kind of a blessing. And it can also be kind of a blessing in the sense that it draws our attention back to where funding is going to come from for this. And the cities have to use private funding, and then that kind of reminds us of the fact that, well, you know, why can't we get private funding from the investors themselves, since, after all, we're talking about a plan that benefits them too, whereas going federal might have sort of lent itself to not getting the funding from private investors. And it seems to be fair and just that private investors should supply the funding. But in any event, you know, for better or worse, we're, you know, all of the action now is at the local level. So that's kind of how we have to proceed.
I'm afraid we're out of time. We could go on for another hour, I think.
Yeah, this is great fun, isn't it?
Really, it's been very interesting.
A great pleasure talking to you again. And I hope we might do it again.
Thank you very much. Great pleasure talking to you.
Great. Thanks so much, Ellen. Okay. Bye for now.
It's time once again for the Public Banking Report, time for us to take a look at some of the activities that are underway and that are developing around the country in cities and towns and counties and states that are pursuing the creation of public banks or taking other grassroots efforts to reclaim control of public monies for their local economies. As reported previously, voters in Vermont this month gave full-throated support for the creation of a public bank in the state. By a margin of 3-1, state citizens told legislators to use the existing Vermont Economic Development Authority as an introductory facility for creating a public bank that can leverage state monies, take deposits, and make loans for in-state projects. Now, that vote was non-binding, but public enthusiasm for the measure was obviously very strong. But when the State Senate Finance Committee heard testimony on the measure last week, Proponents of the bill had to insist on being heard alongside of the private banking lobbyists who had previously been given the floor. The economic impacts of a public bank in the state of Vermont, projected to create over 2,500 new jobs, over $190 million in new economic value, and over $340 million in additional gross state product. Meanwhile, in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, a new economy celebration conference, sponsored by the Thomas Merton Center, gathered several hundred participants to discuss new economic models and existing alternatives for developing local economies in the wake of inadequate funding from state and national programs. Public Banking Institute Director Mike Krause, who also chairs the Pennsylvania Project, shared panel discussions with well-known author and professor and Democracy Collaborative Chair Gar Alperovitz in focusing attention on the remarkable, if underreported, successes of new industrial and cooperative models in which local citizens take new initiatives to create their own economic futures. There were some related public interest banking initiatives also that gained significant traction in the last couple of weeks. One is postal banking, a proposal supported by U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren, which has now been given new momentum by a white paper from the Post Office's Inspector General that would revive a century-old role of letting local post offices provide essential banking services, something especially useful and important for the 20% of Americans who don't have banking relationships. In that void of service, usurious payday lenders and other opportunists have filled the gap for cashing checks, making payments, and offering loans to those who can't afford bank accounts and who must resort to profiteers, some of whom charge hundreds of percent interest to the poorest of citizens. The Post Office report indicates that the postal banking option offers at least 10 significant benefits for the agency, from financial stabilization to maximizing its use of assets across its ubiquitous presence in communities across the country. The measure is also supported by all four postal worker unions. The state of New York has established a so-called green bank with $210 million that's scheduled to start early this year in financing projects that will target development of new jobs, accelerate development and deployment of green energy, modernize the power grid, improve air quality, and more green investment in the state. The chairman of the Energy and Finance Committee for New York State, Richard Kaufman, says that the New York Green Bank will target existing market finance barriers that prevent widespread deployment of green energy. The state is stepping in to help private interests get financing for self-sustaining projects. Now, while this application sounds progressive in that it addresses the serious needs of green energy finance, the state is actually relying on an old model of public financing, namely redirecting assets from other existing state accounts rather than generating new financial resources from a genuine public bank. New York Public Banking Director Scott Baker called the Green Bank a good-sounding idea, but points out that it's not a public bank and will be limited by a lack of financial depth that could otherwise be generated from a true public bank. Meanwhile, public banking initiatives are now underway in states across the country, including Pennsylvania, Washington, California, Florida, New Mexico, New Jersey, Michigan, the District of Columbia, Georgia, New York, and Vermont, of course, to name just a few. If you'd like more information on how to connect with initiatives in your area, visit the Public Banking Institute website at publicbankinginstitute.org. Join us next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown as we take on other leading topics in the monetary news that underlies our economy. You can listen to any of our archived shows on the Progressive Radio Network website, prn.fm. Just go to the shows and look for It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to Wallaby Studios in Philadelphia and to you for listening. On behalf of Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. All best.